Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, or if you're a new listener, welcome to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan, and you're listening at cindysheehansoapbox.com, communityprogressiveradio.org, or something new. We're now at iTunes, so Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox is available to subscribe to at iTunes. I'm very excited about that. I've been working on that for years, literally years. Apparently, it's really hard to figure out what an RSS feed is, especially if you're not a computer genius. So anyway, go to iTunes and look up Cindy Sheehan Soapbox and subscribe to the podcast. Today we have a very moving and special show. I have the parents of courageous and wonderful Rachel Corey, Cindy and Craig Corey, and Rachel, of course, perished in Rafah, Gaza, trying to save Palestinian homes and water wells from being demolished by the Israeli government and military. And Cindy and Craig have had a long struggle for accountability and some kind of justice. So when we come back, we'll be speaking to Cindy and Craig Corey. And this was a national community conference call. So we did invite other people on the call with us. And so I hope you enjoy it, and I hope you learn something from listening to Cindy and Craig. And after Cindy and Craig, I have a short interview with Simon Moyle from the Swan Island Peace Project. And they are going to be blocking a military base down in Australia that works with the U.S. and the war on Afghanistan. And it was very great for me to hear from Australia, to hear that they're doing this peace event, and for them to want to be on my show to promote it. And we need to link peace movements throughout the world, and that's what we talk about, because the movements are so small, unfortunately, right now. So again, stay tuned, and we'll be right back with Cindy and Craig Corey. This is Cindy Sheehan, and this is our community conference call. And I just want to say that there are going to be people who are going to come on later, and I'll be able to tell if somebody else is on. And I'm going to apologize and interrupt and ask them to mute their phones, because I can tell if the recording is going to be insufficient for the radio show this upcoming Sunday. So what the format of this is that Cindy and Craig, I will ask you a few questions, and then we have some questions submitted by listeners. And if they're on the call, not everybody who asks questions are able to be on the call, but if they're on the call, I will ask them to unmute their phone so they can ask you their question. And if we have time at the end and anybody wants to ask another question, anytime during the call, you can email me at cindysheehanssoapbox@gmail.com. If anything comes up during the call that you feel like you have a need to ask the Coreys, then please email me at cindysheehansoapbox@gmail.com, and then I will call on you to ask the question. Another thing is please, the last conference call we had somebody constantly interrupting it. She interrupted the guest and I. So I just want to say, please don't just jump in and interrupt. If you want to ask a question, email me, and I promise you, if we have time, I'll get you in so you can ask your question or make your comment. It's more about being a dialogue. It doesn't necessarily have to be a comment either. So I think that's all I have to say about the mechanics of the call. So I will welcome Cindy and Craig to the show, and we'll get started. Cindy and Craig Corey, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. And Cindy, welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Thank you for having us. It's really, really good to talk with you again.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
Yes, it's nice to talk to you both again. So I'm not going to assume that everybody who listens to my show, especially now that it's up on iTunes, will know about
Rachel, and we'll know about what happened to her. So before we talk about the case and the process that led you back to Israel recently, can you tell the listeners what happened? Tell us about Rachel. Sometimes that's the hardest question for me, is to talk about Casey. But, you know, whatever you feel comfortable, tell us about Rachel and what happened to her and why we're talking to you today.
Well, thank you for asking the question about, you know, to share about Rachel. And I relate to your saying sometimes that's the toughest question, because all of us are complicated people, and we're many different things at many different times in our lives. And I know you know that it's kind of an overwhelming question. And,
yes.
But there are things that, you know, I'm glad to share about Rachel. She was our youngest child. She was we live in Olympia, Washington. She was born here in Olympia. She has an older sister, Sarah, 5 years older, and Chris, 7 years older. She had the spirit, I think, of a third child, and people who have more than one understand that your placement in the family makes a lot of difference. And
yes.
I think she had a lot of the characteristics of third children. She was all her life just a very creative person from the time she was a really small child. I forget sometimes how to share that, but one thing I'm reminded of, Craig usually tells people that he remembers when someone asked Rachel, a colleague of his, what she wanted to be when she grew up, and she said, "I am a poet." And she certainly was a writer, you know, and a thinker. And she said that at a very young age, and she was writing poetry at a very young age. She kind of, to jump to the chase, she was impacted like all of us were, like your family was, with 9/11 in the United States. And she was a college student at the time. She wondered what it was that she started to think more about what it was that made that happen. And Craig and I were living in North Carolina at the time. Rachel was here in Olympia. She was attending the Evergreen State College. And she was involved in her program at Evergreen was called Local Knowledge. There were two faculty members and a group of students that spent really the whole year together. And the goal of the program originally was to dig beneath the surface here within our local area in Washington State to look for hidden histories. And because of what happened nationally and internationally, I think it really led to them and to Rachel looking beneath the surface, or belief, at least what was beneath the surface of her knowledge about what was going on in the Middle East and so forth. And she became very involved in the peace movement particularly when the U.S. Was moving toward war with Afghanistan and Iraq. And she was a strong opponent and of those ventures. And she was drawn to the issue of Israel and Palestine through looking at what some of the root causes of all of this were. And in 2002, there was an organization, the International Solidarity Movement, was formed. This was after the start of the second Intifada, or uprising, throwing off is the translation of it in Arabic, that began in 2000 in Israel and Palestine. And there was violence during that time, and the Palestinians had lived under occupation for decades, and their situation was worsening, and this was a particularly difficult time. There was a resolution in the United Nations to bring a human rights monitoring force to the region, and that was vetoed by the United States and Israel. And as a result, activist in Israel and Palestine and in the United States developed the idea of the international solidarity movement and bringing internationals to come to try to offer some to be in solidarity nonviolently with Palestinians who were really bearing the brunt of the occupation and of what was happening at the time. And some of Rachel's friends in 2002 went to really the first large surge of people that were going with ISM. They, of course, came back and talked about their experiences. Rachel was staying very closely in touch with them. And it was really during that period that she developed her own interest in going. She studied Arabic. She was learning all that she could about the situation. Our family was not connected to the Middle East in a direct way before this time. And I think we're like a lot of other Americans in that regard. It was just that problem that never went away. And we were pretty distanced from it. But, you know, she started learning. I was in North Carolina and had time, and she was really supporting our learning. She wanted us to know as much about what she was going to be doing as she could help us learn. So she supported that in a lot of different ways. In January of 2003, she went to Israel through Ben Gurion Airport. She went directly to the West Bank for training with the ISM in a village near Bethlehem in Beit Sahur. She had a couple of days of training there, and then she had chosen to go to Gaza and to Rafah specifically, which is at the southern part of the Gaza Strip, because a friend who had gone previously said that the need was so great there and that Rafah was possibly the most forsaken part of the entire area. And so she went there very deliberately with very intentional goals. And, of course, there was a tremendous amount to learn. But there she was working with other activists. She was there for 7 weeks doing many different things. And one of her ideas before she left Olympia, because she believed in maintaining connections and building relationships, was to talk with a friend at the Evergreen State College, a person in administration there who had created a sister county relationship with Santa Tomas, Nicaragua, in our county, Thurston County, which is now maybe 25 or 30 years old. And so Rachel wanted to learn how Jean had gone about doing that and had the idea that something similar could happen between Olympia and Rafah. So she had lots of ideas. She worked with women and children and with other activists because of what was happening in the Gaza Strip at the time. There were massive home demolitions occurring. There was much violence from the Israeli military against the civilian population of Gaza. Wells were threatened and damaged and destroyed. And so Rachel, with other activists, was, when called upon by families, would stay in houses that were threatened. The thinking, these were houses that were right along the border, and they were being cleared. Whole blocks of houses were being cleared away to create a buffer zone. And with the wells, the activists would try to, with their signs and their banners and so forth, to be out, sometimes actually with much smaller bulldozers, but Palestinian bulldozers that were trying to work to repair the damage that had been done to the water, to the wells, and to the infrastructure there. But they would get fired upon from military towers. And so the activists were there to, and they would report to the IDF, and the water workers would report to the IDF, the Israeli military, that they were going to be doing this work. But still, we received reports about how the soldiers would fire, you know, at the feet of the activists and so forth. So this was some of what she was doing. On March 16, 2003, she was called to a site where two bulldozers had appeared. Each of them had two people inside, and there was an armored personnel carrier. The commander of the on the ground that day was in the armored personnel carrier. these machines came up and threatened structures, pushed against structures, some of which were, I think, already abandoned because people came under such threat that they would leave their houses and then they would be demolished. And so they were pushing against structures and so forth and moving back and forth in the area. Two of the activists, we learned later that the bulldozers came right up to them, pushed one into concertina wire, but then stopped. They were there for several hours. Late in the afternoon, around 5 o'clock, the activists thought they had succeeded in stopping this action because the bulldozers had gone out to the border. They had moved several times, and this time they went out to the border. It looked like they would be leaving, but instead they came back, and one of the bulldozers came toward a house where Rachel had stayed. There were two brothers who lived in the house, and their families were behind the garden wall, watching through a crack in the garden wall as the bulldozer approached. Rachel, of course, knew that they were there, and as the bulldozer kept coming, she knelt to show that she was not going to move. She then, according to the seven ISM activists that were there, four of whom testified in the trial, she climbed the pile and rose to a point where she was actually would be looking into the cab of the bulldozer. But it did not stop. It continued over her. I'd also say Rachel was 5'10" tall. She was not a small person. And one of the activists said her arms were in the air, that she had raised her arms in the air. The bulldozer moved over her. And she lost her footing when that started to happen. And the bulldozer went over her. They stopped. The activists were screaming and so forth to tell the bulldozer to stop. Instead, it stopped and then backed over her again. And she died a short time later, being supported by her friends who were there with her.
Cindy, thank you so much. So you tried to get accountability, and if you join the call later and you haven't muted your phone, please mute your phone using *6, and so we can get a better recording. Thank you. Craig, did you have anything to add to that?
No, that's kind of a long conversation,
yeah.
But to pull it a little bit farther forward. We found out about this actually sort of originally our daughter, Sarah, found out about it by a telephone call that went into the message machine at the time, and a neighbor said she just heard about the tragedy, and she, she could do anything to talk to her, and Sarah wondered what tragedy. And I think she mentioned she'd heard about it on TV, so Sarah turned on the TV, and she could see one of those banners going across the bottom said Olympia woman killed in the Gaza Strip. And
oh my God, what a way
so,
to find out.
So Sarah called us, and at that time it was still sort of rumor, and I called our son in D.C., and he got a hold of the State Department, but then he called me back, said, I think they're just seeing about it on TV like we are. And so our first inclination was that we would go to Gaza, to bring Rachel home, and that got us starting with the State Department. We flew to D.C. where our son was living and thought we would go from there. But this was Sunday, and the actual invasion into Iraq happened, I believe, Wednesday, 3 days later. So we were told we couldn't come there, and then we found out, well, the embassy was at, I think, one-third staff, which gave us a hint, and about a day later, we had confirmed that the war was starting. So we worked with the State Department to get Rachel's body home, and that sort of started a process working with our congressman in the State Department. We were told really early on, and it's still out, I think, on the State Department's website, that President Bush talked to Prime Minister Sharon a day after Rachel was killed and was promised by Sharon a thorough, credible, and transparent, those are their words, not ours, investigation of Rachel's killing, with a report to be given to the U.S. government. But about, and I'm not certain about this, but 6 to 8 weeks later, we heard that the Israeli government had closed their investigation, found no fault with the military, and declined to give any a report to the U.S. government. Subsequently, there was a legal opinion that was written by a lawyer in Israel. Our embassy was allowed to read that, but not given a copy. They just could read it, and then Israel took back the copy, and our family's been able to read that report on a couple of occasions, and we have taken detailed notes of that report. But based on that report, the State Department said that, in their opinion, that did not indicate a thorough, credible, and transparent investigation. And that was put into writing by Colin Powell's chief of staff in June of 2004. And actually, the chief of staff, some people may recognize his name, Lawrence Welkerson, Larry Welkerson, he had told us by that time if it were his daughter, he would sue Israel. And that really became the advice of the State Department, and we had 2 years from her killing to determine that. And by that time, it looked as if the any sort of diplomatic means might not bear fruit, and a private lawsuit is really the only means that we can control to bring things forward, at least be able to have somebody asking some questions about what happened to our daughter. So that's we did file a civil lawsuit on, I think that was March 15th of 2005, so 1 day short of 2 years after Rachel was killed. Our first day in court was on March 10th of 2010. I believe there were 15 days, hearing days. Is that right, Cindy?
Yes.
And they were scattered.
Yes, you're right.
And they were scattered because it's only heard by a judge. There's no jury, and there's one judge. So the last hearing date was July 10th of 2011. So that was about a year and 4 months after the first date. And then the verdict was actually given on August 28th of this year. So we just 2 days ago got back from the Middle East from hearing that verdict. And we can go into that verdict here in a second.
Yes, I would like to for you to go into the verdict about what happened in the case, and then we'll go on to the next question. But tell us, I think probably everybody on the call knows, but for, like I said, for people who might not know, what was the verdict and what was your reaction? We know, the international reaction of people who do Palestine solidarity and who've been in solidarity with you was very disappointing. We were all very disappointed in the verdict, but really not too surprised. So what was the verdict, and what were your personal reactions like when you heard it?
There were a few things I'd like for people to know about the day. The verdict occurred at 9 a.m. in the morning. And, of course, we'd been in the court, in Haifa District Court, numerous times before on 15 other occasions. That morning, we walked up with our attorney, and the walkway in, where you go through security and so forth, was lined with friends, people who had been there in court to support us, people we've come to know during this process, Palestinian Israelis and Jewish Israelis and members of legal and human rights organizations and so forth. So we had a great support system there, which was really wonderful. It really felt important that morning. And our attorneys, our lead attorney is Hussein Abu Hussein. He has practiced for many years, is Palestinian-Israeli from a village called Umm al-Fahm, which is not far from Haifa. He's a remarkable person, and the work that he does, I think, is amazing to watch. It's what it demands of our attorneys. This whole case is kind of beyond imagination. I don't think we envisioned what it would require of them.
Uh-huh.
They've been wonderful. But that morning, there was a lot of media there, international and local media, and which I was uncomfortable on the one hand, but was very, very helpful on the other hand in getting the word out. So I think a lot of people do know about the verdict. It had to be translated, of course, to Craig and me because everything in the court is in Hebrew. I could tell right away from my friend, Israeli friend, who was translating next to me, just the tone of her voice, kind of the, she kept apologizing, and I think she was having trouble saying the words. The judge was an interesting personality. There are, as Craig said, there are no juries. It's in Israel. This was heard by one judge. We knew from the beginning that it was going to be difficult, and we remained hopeful. I had a lot of hope that somehow this judge would be able to get past, I think, what is just this very basic ingrained support, very extensive support for the military that permeates the entire country. And we knew it certainly had impacted the investigation into Rachel's case from everything that we had seen, and not just us, but the U.S. government saw that. But it became clear hearing the verdict. I mean, that, and it's not, again, it's not just us saying this. There have been things written recently about how the courts also are implicated in really supporting impunity for the military in the occupied territories. And
uh-huh.
with the judge's verdict, he found that this was an act of war, and that therefore, really, no matter what, according to Israeli law, no matter what occurred there, the military had no responsibility. And this, I think, is probably the most concerning part of the decision for us because of the implications that it has for all civilians, and not just Rachel, but for going forward, if positions like this are allowed to stand. It's a threat to anybody that finds himself in a conflict situation there and elsewhere. He also found, that Rachel, he determined that Rachel couldn't be seen, that it was not at all an intentional act, that it was an accident, certainly an accident. And we can talk about that further, but our family has very serious questions about that. And he determined that the only person who had any responsibility for what happened to Rachel was Rachel herself.
Right.
In the summary of it, he said that she was the person who could see, and that she didn't move from the bulldozer, and so all the responsibility was placed on Rachel. It was pretty shocking, actually. If this is a bit of a side story, but a few months after Rachel was killed, there was a soldier killed in the West Bank. When a D9 bulldozer, also someone in it, pushed down a barrier, and there was a soldier on the other side. The person on the other side of the barrier was killed, and that person clearly could not be seen. I mean, there was no question about it. News reports about it indicated that the commander of the unit was at least temporarily dismissed, that there were investigations. They talked about all the regulations that had been broken with what happened in that case, and they were going to determine whether there were criminal charges. We never saw more media reports about that, so I don't know ultimately what happened. But I thought it was striking to see the difference, no matter the testimony, no matter what the soldiers did out there that day, the judge thought they had performed perfectly. And he also spoke to the investigation and thought that it was just a flawless investigation. So on every point, it felt to us very much like we didn't really have to be in court for 16 months. that what he did was to look at what the state's attorneys had written originally and just went down the line, really accepting their position completely. And, of course, we have a lot of problems with their position. As far as how we felt that day, I guess, you know, because of, I think, having that optimism that I always try to hang on to, initially, of course, there was disappointment, and then I was kind of annoyed with myself, you know, uh-huh. for holding on to that optimism, and then pretty soon, you know, just very disturbed and pretty disgusted with what happened, frankly. So that's
Let me go to Craig. And if you call, if you just got on the call, please unmute yourself at *6. I'm hearing a little background noise. So if you're not muted and you're on the call, please mute yourself at *6. Thank you. So Craig, this kind of like goes right perfectly into a question I had. Recently you said, we will continue. The judge accepted the testimony that the bulldozer had a blind spot. The real blind spot is Israel's towards humanity. So this call is called Justice for Rachel. Do we have any, you know, you said you are going to continue. What are the next steps? What realistically can be done now to get justice for what happened to Rachel?
Well, I think that, for one thing, that that ruling that you can do anything you want to in war, that excuses all actions, it has to be challenged. So immediately coming out of the courtroom, our attorney was saying, well, you know, take this to the High Court of Israel. And we're trying to take steps to go forward with that. I think, you know, looking at it, and there would be no ruling on that for 2.5 to 4 years. So, you know, we're signing up for quite a bit more time in this process in doing that. But I think if we can find that we've got the, you know, strength to go forward with that and the funds, then we'll do that. So we're taking the steps to file that appeal, and that decision has to be made fairly quickly this fall, though there's been some relief in how quickly that has to be done. And I'm only hedging it because until we file that, I'm not going to promise to do it. But all our steps are towards doing that and just figuring out how we can do that. And I think that it's very important. I think that, you know, through this process, I don't know about you, but it's, I start wondering even what justice is. Right shortly after Rachel was killed, a friend, a woman that reached out and met us in the weeks right following Rachel's killing, gave me a book by Desmond Tutu, and it talked about the restorative justice that went on in South Africa. And in his book, he explains the process quite different from our justice system. But there, the first thing you do is you would find out the facts about what happened. The second thing is that everybody would openly take responsibility for their part in that. And then you would work to, as he puts it, I think, mend the tear that has happened to society by whatever went on. And of course, our Western sort of justice is that we try to balance one pain with another pain, you know. So a result of a lawsuit would be financial money coming back the other way, which seems really ugly in a lot, but that's the only avenue that's open. And if it's a criminal, then somebody gets locked up. And neither one of those really satisfies that idea of trying to mend society so it can heal. But that's sort of philosophical idea about justice. I do think that you can't go forward with an idea that you can say we're in, you know, it's an act of war, and so we can do whatever we want. And of course, legally, you can't have an act, you know, it can't be war against a area that's under your occupation, that under international law, far from saying, as the military did, you know, we heard colonel saying that there's no such thing as a civilian in war. And so under oath, people were saying they were at war at everybody, with everybody in the Gaza Strip. And when they're saying that, I'm thinking the children that were behind the wall that Rachel, I'll get the right female in my last name here, Rachel was standing in front of, you know, there were children behind that wall. There were two families that were behind that wall. And it's just total lack of recognition of their humanity. And that can't be allowed to stand. So we have to work against that. And the next steps doing that legally would be to take it to the high court. And I think, to me, there's something really important whether you expect to get justice. I think that what you have to do is demand it. That's the first thing. That's the thing we can control. We can go into court. We can hold this mirror up to the court of Israel and demand justice and do our best to give them the opportunity to make some changes and to, I think, hold their own military responsible for what goes on. And I think in the end, it's not, I mean, again, I was in Vietnam. I was a squad leader in Vietnam. It's not really about trying to hold somebody accountable after they do these acts. It's about having a military that's under control and doesn't commit these sort of inhuman acts. And what was clear from going through court and listening to the commanders is that far from trying to hold their military in that sort of control and discipline, they were given the green light to massive human rights violations, which did occur there. So you could see them testifying. For instance, a colonel had written in the log for the operations log for the day that Rachel was killed that the standing order was to shoot to kill every adult that was in this in the area that Rachel was in. Well, you know, that was a neighborhood, and houses had been destroyed there, but the Nasrallah house still stood, and you can't just shoot to kill somebody that walks in there. And in fact, you know, they did shoot and kill two other internationals within 7 weeks along that line. Tom Herndl was killed when he was with the International Solidarity Movement, and they walked in front of a mosque to try to allow people to go and pray in the mosque without being harassed by the Israeli military. And from the border, soldiers started shooting, and all the adults ran for cover, but three or four small children froze instead of running. And so Tom went out and picked up one child, brought him back to safety, went out to pick up another, and was shot through the head, subsequently died of his wounds. And then James Miller is an award-winning photographer, and he was filming about house demolitions and the effect on children in the Gaza Strip, and he was shot and killed down there. So those two adults were killed, and then the little child, Iman, was shot and killed. And somehow the tape of the Israeli military soldiers talking about shooting at her, pinning her down behind a mound of earth, and then a captain went out and, quote, confirmed the kill by firing at her point blank, 13-year-old child, you know, killed. That's what was going on, and you can see that in the orders that they wrote down in the log, and you can hear these field grade officers saying, yes, that's the sort of orders they gave there. That's what they were condoning. And then eventually that's what the courts on sober deliberation decided that they too would condone. And we just have to fight that.
How do we, one of the things that I wanted to talk about in this call, and we should get to the questions from the listeners very quickly, is you say it's going to cost money, and I'm sure your long struggle has been very financially draining. What do you support yourself, and how does the Rachel Corey Peace and Justice Foundation, or Foundation for Peace and Justice, how does that work, and is that foundation involved in this struggle?
The Rachel Corrie Foundation is here in Olympia. Craig and I are very involved with it. I when I'm not working on being at court and so forth, I'm spending a lot of time there as a volunteer. Craig and I are both volunteers there. We were very fortunate in a way that when Rachel was killed, she was our youngest child, we were in a position that we could stop and focus on this. And that's what we've done. But the work of the foundation is, it's multifaceted, but it's to really educate about this issue and to build connections and to work in peace and justice, supporting grassroots activism around this issue, particularly in the Middle East. But with the trial, the foundation's focus is purely to educate, and that's why the website does have a lot of material about the trial. People can go there. It's RachelCorrieFoundation.org, and people can go there and find press releases. They can find statements about the case itself. Eventually, we will have some of the transcripts. We've translated the Hebrew into English, so we will have material there from the trial that people would be able to utilize, and we want people to have access to it to see what's been said in court and you know what transpired there. But as far as supporting the legal costs, that is not a function of the foundation. It's not something that the foundation has done. To this point, our family has managed to cover our own expenses for the travel, and we were in Israel for about 9 months during this period because of all the court dates. Our attorneys really, we paid basic costs, but they were very generous with us. But going forward, if it is to go forward, we will need support. And our attorneys and their staff need to be paid. And so, and we feel like this appeal is so much larger. If this happens, it's so much larger than Rachel. As I said, it's about challenging this idea that during war, during conflict, militaries aren't responsible. So we don't know yet quite what the mechanism will be, but we're just back from Israel, so we will be looking into, and with the help of some friends here in the U.S., looking into how we set up some kind of legal fund for it. We're not sure yet if that will be through the Rachel Corrie Foundation. It's likely not to be, just because we don't want to create any problems or misunderstandings about the work of the foundation and so forth. But if people, what people can expect for people, of course, we and our attorneys would be immensely grateful for any support that is there and that comes forward, and we will communicate about how that can happen. And this will be a fairly lengthy process. And I'm sure there will be information at the Rachel Corrie Foundation website eventually about how people can contribute to a legal fund if they'd like to do that.
Great, thank you. Well, we are running into only 15 minutes left of the call, and we have a few callers' questions or supporters' questions, and I want to call on the supporters now if they're on the phone. And if they're not, if they're on this call, if they're not, I'll ask a question, because this call is being recorded and it will be played on my radio show this Sunday.
My name's Diane G. So I'm going to go ahead and jump in here because I have a radio show and I know how it is.
Yeah.
Hey, Diane, it's Cindy.
Oh,
yeah, I had all of a sudden my signal just like dropped off. But Diane, go ahead. You had a question. So go ahead and ask your question while you're there.
Sorry, I just didn't want you to be.
No problem. Go ahead and ask your question.
Well, first of all, my heart goes out to you. I'm the youngest of five. We lost my oldest sister. She was 18. I was 6. I know what it does to a family. It was a tragedy and an accident, not of the magnitude of yours, but my heart goes out to you to start out. The first point, I have two brief questions. The first thing is that I saw throughout the transcript that even the driver himself said the deceased climbed on the dirt pile and then later denied saying it, and there was film. Now, I've been following this from the very, very start, and because I've been following Israeli-Palestinian politics for a while. The film and the camera angles, weren't those admissible? I mean, how could they not see that he could see her?
I think it's interesting that you bring that up. There was some film. The film was taken from the border area, and some people may have seen that. There's actually a documentary that an Israeli filmmaker, Simone Biton, made called Rachel, and in that there shows some of the video that was taken by the Israeli Defense Force, and that clip that is in that film was also given to the U.S. government, but that was not admitted into court. We asked for all the film that had been taken that day to be sent in, and what was sent was another clip of a similar length, about 12 minutes, but it actually started right at the point when Rachel was killed. The camera was pointed away from Rachel when she was killed. So it doesn't show exactly what happened at that time. Also, the film that's been released has, you know, it's actually it's TV footage or a different story. It's electromagnetic, so I'm not sure film is the right word, but it's very grainy, very difficult to see people. But you can see movement and what people were doing at that time. It also recorded the radio transmissions between the vehicles and the vehicles in their base when it was going on. So I guess what I'm saying is the film does not show that, and it wouldn't be clear enough. What was given to anybody wouldn't be clear enough to actually show those angles. You can see pictures that Rachel's friends took, which make it clear that, you know, under normal circumstances, you can see into those cabs, and the people that were in the cabs can see out. I'd also say, as a ex-military person who had some responsibility for bulldozers in Vietnam, not under these circumstances, but it's also it's your responsibility to know what's in front of that blade. So if there were blind spots, they knew that months, if not years, in advance, and they could have done something about that. They could also use some techniques of positioning. There were three vehicles there that day, each bulldozer, two of them were bulldozers, each had two people in them. And then there was an armored personnel carrier. So they could be looking out for each other. The armored personnel carrier could be positioned so it could see in front of the blades. None of that happened. And amazingly, the people doing the investigation claimed that there was no other film except what was delivered to the court. And why they were claiming that, you could go on to Israeli national TV and see this documentary in which other film was shown, and we tried to bring that up, but we're not allowed to get anything in court because it's not our film, it's the Israeli military film, and so we can't get it entered into court. What we did do after the court proceedings were done or the testimony was done, so in July of last year, we had a press conference, and we handed out DVD that showed the film that was admitted into court. It showed the film that had been shown previously on Israeli TV, and showed the difference and what was important about those two pieces of film. And one Israeli TV channel took this, went back out to the defense attorneys for the State of Israel, and they said there's no other film besides what was entered into court. So they got that statement from the defense attorneys, and then they showed the film that was not admitted into court that evening on their 8 o'clock news. So that point is made across the world and across Israel, but it was not made inside the courtroom.
There are issues about the tape that I just want to quickly say.
Can I just interrupt? Yeah. Because if you're not at this point, if you're not me or Cindy or Craig, could you mute your phone because I'm hearing heavy breathing on the line? I don't know if we have star 6, please? Sounds like we have what are those calls called? Yeah, can you *6, please, your phone? If you're not Craig or Cindy or Cindy. Okay, thank you. What are those calls called when you get a heavy breather calling?
I know.
That's what it sounded like.
My brief follow-up to that is that you both said that you're talking about and going back and trying to have this overturned, and then I'll see the floor and mute. Right now we've got Netanyahu, who is very right-wing, far right-wing. Even Israelis are objecting to how right-wing he is. There's an election in 13. Do you have hope that a more leftist government will come into power and possibly be more open to overturning this?
Well, ideally, we wouldn't have to look for a change in the government to have it overturned. I mean, you would hope that the judiciary would be independent enough that that could happen. But as I said, if you look to Israeli legal and human rights organizations, they are starting to talk about the problems within the court. There are people there who are working for change. So I do hope for change, but I think that in many ways, despite the verdict, I always felt that this was a win-win situation for us because what we were doing was trying to expose these institutions. We were trying to get information. We were trying to determine the facts of what happened. And I think as difficult as it's been, I think we've been successful at that. We were in Nazareth a few days ago speaking to it's an Arab Association for Human Rights gathering, and the room was full of people, Palestinian Israelis, sitting around that table. And as I looked at the faces, I knew that everyone had a powerful story, and there were very brave people in that room. And I think I heard our attorney talk to them about how rarely a case like this gets adjudicated, gets carried through a full trial process, so that you actually have soldiers and this number of soldiers having to testify in court. And so even as we go forward, we can't anticipate. Of course, we would hope for it to be overturned. But even if that were not to happen, I have confidence that through the process, we would hopefully make some progress. I just want to say a couple of things about the videotape. That tape, we learned from the portion that was given to the U.S. government originally that the camera turned away exactly 5 minutes before Rachel was killed. We also have learned that the soldiers were given new orders around that time, and that's when the bulldozer returned and Rachel was killed. Prior to the camera turning away, it's focused on the bulldozers and on the activists. And, of course, that provides a lot of information about the terrain, about how the activists were actually moving and where they were positioned and how the bulldozers were moving and so forth. None of that was in the court, and that, for whatever reason, that videotape was not confiscated by the military police investigating team that began on March 17th of 2003. It was confiscated by senior commanders. That was testified to by the lead investigator, and they had that tape for a week. And they were the ones that determined what part of the tape actually, I think, went to the lead investigator. But also, that's the piece that came to the court, and we didn't figure out until we got there that it was a very shortened version of it. The other thing about the tape is that it was actually Simone Bitton, the filmmaker, who was given a piece that was in color. And there was no color tape that was ever given to the U.S. or that was given to the court. But when you see the piece that's in color, you see the orange jackets and how brightly they stand out and how visible that makes those activists who were wearing them. So I just wanted to share with you that there are some very key pieces of key questions that arise from the fact that the videotape was not provided, and that it was in the hands of senior commanders.
Thank you, Cindy and Craig and the listeners. I'm sorry we ran out of time. Cindy and Craig, you have been generous with your time, and I know you're exhausted from, you know, me being an international traveler myself. And I just want to thank you so much for taking the time to come on and talk about it. We, even though we didn't get to very many listeners' questions, we covered a lot of information. But is there any way that people can reach you or email you directly with the question?
Absolutely. I wish we were shorter in replying, and I care about your questions. People can email to us at the Rachel Corrie Foundation. So you can email to info@rachelcorriefoundation.org. Actually, an email that goes to me at Cindy, it's Cindy@rachelcorriefoundation.org, would also get through. And we would do our best to provide timely answers to any questions you have.
Do you have anything to add before we end this interview, this call?
I think we've covered, you know, what we can. As you know, Cindy, it's all these things. It's people interview you and say, sum up the last 10 years of your life.
Yeah,
you can't
exactly
quite do that. But,
well,
but I think we have covered a lot, and I just thank you and your listeners for the opportunity to talk to them.
And take care of yourself, you guys.
Thank
go
you.
Ahead.
And
I'm sorry.
Well.
Thank you.
Cindy, were you going to say something?
Well, if there's a moment, I'd like to add, because the person who did ask a question mentioned the loss in his own family, and I'm sure you agree, Cindy, that one of
her own family, but she has a cold. She might have sounded like a guy, but she has a cold.
Sorry.
So she has a sore throat, so that's probably why her voice sounded very deep.
I apologize for that, but I just want you to know that many people have come to us because of the fact that they've lost people in their lives. And, of course, we all have that experience in some way, but losing children and losing siblings is the worst. And I think we all think that's the most difficult thing. But the losses that we all have, I know that we share those, that we all feel those same losses, and we all have to find ways to make sense out of them. I feel that Craig and I have been blessed because so many people have helped us do that. And I just want people to understand that I recognize that the losses, no matter how they happen, that's something, the nature of those, that's something that we share.
Well, thank you so much. And like I said before, I know how hard it is to mourn a child and then still go out and try to change the world and make things better. And so I honor your sacrifices, too. I know that you both are making tremendous physical and emotional sacrifices to do what you do. So, again, thank you so much for taking the time to be on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I love you guys.
Thank you, Cindy.
Thanks,
thank
Cindy.
Thank you very much.
Okay, we'll talk to you soon, I hope. Thank you.
Well, that was Cindy and Craig Corrie. Very, very moving, very inspirational. Right now, I'm going to welcome Simon Moyle to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Simon Moyle, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Thanks so much for having me on.
And where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Melbourne in Australia, down in the very south of our continent.
The other side of the world from us. So welcome to the show. Tell my listeners what you're planning and why you're planning it.
Sure. So obviously we've been involved in the war in Afghanistan along with the United States for almost 11 years now, coming up to 11 years. And so there's been a group of us who have been doing, I suppose, nonviolent resistance to that war and to Australia's preparations for it for a number of years. So this is part of that, part of our ongoing resistance to the war. And so what we're doing is actually going down to a base south of Melbourne, on the coast of Melbourne, one of the most secretive bases in Australia, actually. It's called the Swan Island Military Base. And it's a place where SAS troops are trained, special forces. And also it's a place where ASIS, who is kind of like our equivalent of the CIA, since the overseas spies in Australia operate out of this base. And so there's kind of, they say there's less known about this base than about Pine Gap. And so for a number of years now, we've been trying to both expose what's going on in this base, but also to resist its contribution to the war in Afghanistan, and particularly by resisting and disrupting the activities of the SAS, who are, for Australia, as far as Australia is concerned, carrying most of the kind of combat role in the war in Afghanistan.
And what is the mood? I've been to Australia, and I did some work with the peace community there. And what is the mood? What is the energy of the peace movement in Australia right now? And the mood of the people, are the people supportive of the, I'm talking about the majority, supportive? Do they oppose? Do they, anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. So I guess in Australia, we're pretty generally pretty apathetic. I think for us, as in most of the world, 2003 was a big turning point for protest movements everywhere, when we all kind of got out on the streets, and there were 250,000 people on the streets of Melbourne, of my city, which is the biggest, as we know, the biggest protest in the history of the world, happened in the lead up to the Iraq War, and of course that war went ahead. And so one of the effects that had is basically to kind of decimate the peace movement. So the group that we have now, we tend to call ourselves the peace remnants rather than the peace movement. But generally, the Australian public is against this war. So, but it's a very passive opposition, if you like. So I think the stats are somewhere between 65 and 70% of Australians think that we should end our involvement in the war, but that's a very, very passive opposition.
I think we have the same kind of situation here in the United States with, I guess if you ask somebody, they would say, yes, let's end it, but I don't think it's something that most people think about in their daily lives at all, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's right.
Because we know the people of Afghanistan and Pakistan have to suffer through it on a daily basis. And so, well, and what days are you going to do your protest?
So we're going down on the 23rd of September. We're going to be there till the 27th. We're going to be running a whole lot of activities from, you know, nonviolence training and picketing through to blockading the base. And I guess opening it up to people's creativity as to what else they would like to do. So we've got a whole bunch of kids' activities, and kids are kind of welcome and encouraged to participate at whatever level they feel comfortable. We've got a whole lot of new people as well who have not done this stuff before. So we've kind of grown this movement, I suppose, around Swan Island from four of us in 2010 who actually crossed into the base and disrupted the base for a whole day, to now we're looking at sort of 8, you know, possibly sort of 80 people. So
wow.
Gradually kind of getting up there, but still a lot of work to go.
Okay, and will you be live streaming it, or do you have a website where people can get more information?
Yeah, we've got a website, swanislandpeace.org. So that's all one word, swanislandpeace.org. We haven't looked at live streaming yet, but we could do that. We've got a whole lot of information up there, both about what we're doing, but also about some of the reasons why we're doing it as well, and encouraging people to think about nonviolence and what that means, not just for this kind of event, but for the rest of our life and for the way we do politics in general. And so a whole lot of information there that people are welcome to check out.
Great. That sounds really worthwhile, Simon, and I hope you get a lot of support. Is there anything that you'd like to add?
I think It'd just be great to feel, I guess, have that sense of solidarity across the ocean. You know, we're pretty small, and probably it feels pretty small for the, you know, in the US peace movement as well. And I think it's important that we keep encouraging each other, keep telling the stories of resistance and of the resistance that is happening to these wars, and encouraging, I think, particularly the veterans of these wars, that there are people who care about what they're going through, and also, I guess, connecting with the Afghan people as well. So one of the things I did last year was actually went to Afghanistan and spent time with some young people there called the Afghan Peace Volunteers. And what they're asking of us is that we become their friends and that we realise that war has not helped their country. And so those are some of the things you can do. You can go to globaldaysoflistening.org to regularly chat with those young people and get to know them. So it's not just an abstract issue.
What was that website?
Globaldaysoflistening.org.
Global Days of Listening?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, great. Okay, Simon, well, thank you, and I'll be sending my message of solidarity, and thank you all for doing this, and you're right, we need to work together, you know, reach across borders to work together, because it's just so urgent right now. So, Simon Moyle, thanks to you and the comrades and everybody, and thanks for coming on the show and telling us what you're doing.
Pleasure. Thanks so much for having me, Cindy.
Okay, Simon. Thank you.
That was our show for today, and I'd like to thank Cindy and Craig for being so generous with their time, especially after just getting back from Israel, and they were so exhausted. And I heard from other people on the call who said they were very inspired and very moved by the call. And I hope that you were very inspired and moved by this show. And I'd like to thank Simon for coordinating with me on this huge time difference between California and Australia. And I wish them good luck on their action, and hopefully we'll have wonderful reports. As always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Don DeBar, and he's also from Community Progressive Radio. My associate producer, Mikey, for setting the call up with the Corys. I'd like to thank you for listening and supporting the show. And we're going to close with a song from Billy Bragg. And Billy Bragg, I love his rendition of The International. But this song is called The Lonesome Death of Rachel Corey. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. Peace out for now.
An Israeli bulldozer killed poor Rachel Corey as she stood in its path in the township of Rafah. She lost her young life in an act of compassion, trying to protect the poor people of Gaza, whose homes are destroyed by tank shells and bulldozers, and whose plight is exploited by suicide bombers who kill in the name of the people of Gaza. But Rachel Corey believed in nonviolent resistance, put herself in harm's way as a shield of the people, and paid with her life in a manner most brutal. But you who philosophize disgrace and criticize our fears, take the rag away from your face, 'cause now ain't the time for your tears. Rachel Corey had 23 years. She was born in the town of Olympia, Washington, a skinny, messy, list-making chain smoker who volunteered to protect the Palestinian people who had become non-persons in the eyes of the media, so that people were suffering and no one was seeing or hearing or talking or caring or acting, and the horrible math of the awful equation that brought Rachel Corrie into this confrontation is that the spilled blood of a single American is worth more than the blood of 100 Palestinians. But you who philosophize disgrace and criticize our fears, take the rag away from your face, 'cause now ain't the time for your tears. The artistic director of a New York theater canceled a play based on Rachel's writings, but she wasn't a bomber or a killer or a fighter, but one who acted in the spirit of the Freedom Riders. Is there no place for such a voice in America that doesn't conform to the Fox News agenda, who believes in non-violence instead of brute force, who is willing to confront the might of an army whose passionate beliefs were matched by her bravery? And the question she asked rings out round the world: if America is truly the beacon of freedom, then how can it stand by while they bring down the curtain and turn Rachel Corrie into a non-person? Oh, but you who philosophize disgrace, criticize our fears, bury the rag deep in your face, 'cause now is the time